going to go ahead and get started. Our council meeting today is Tuesday, December 18th, 2018, and it is 11:00 p.m. You're going to go ahead and start with a pledge given by Councilmember Bailey and then you can issue it by Mr. Ellsberg.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Our Heavenly Father, we're grateful for this opportunity to meet with the City Council to cover the business of the city. Wisdom and insight into what the best options are and best way forward for the things that are presented to us today. Here to listen to us.
Amen. Thank you. Now I see an approval of the agenda.
I will move that we approve the agenda.
That motion made by Councilmember Anderson. Is there a second?
Yes, sir.
Second by Councilmember Bailey. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? We'll move on to the public comment portion of the meeting. Stand up for three individuals. You come up to the podium and you'll just start with your name and your address, and then you will have 3 minutes. And the first one is Scott Richards.
Good evening. Addressing today on item.
Sorry, you should start with your name and address. Sorry.
Scott Richards, 9562 Lincoln Circle. I come to you on item number 12. I'll be addressing tonight on the business and discussion of business licensing and home occupations. And we're representing a client who has a property there. I guess it'd be on the. I guess it's not the furthest south, but it's the south end of the city. And he has 1.2 acres. And he wants to build an accessory building on the back and use part of it for his commercial use. He's a photographer, videographer, and mostly does all his work on the road, but occasionally 1 or 2 days a week, a month. You know, he does some filming, but he's got a property that does not impact the neighborhood. It's not seen by anybody, but pretty noisy basements and other things and other issues. So we looked at the ordinances that were involved there at the time, or that's in place right now, and according to those, we cannot move forward with that because we disclosed it was a commercial use. But if he didn't have a commercial use, he could build that, but I'd say 90% of it is personal use and occasional use for that. And if he so happens to sell the property later on, it could be converted to an accessory unit for someone living. You know, so in that sense, so that's kind of the background of what generated this. So we were going back and forth speaking with Chandler and such, and we thought maybe a better way might be to change the ordinances on business licensing, especially on properties that can accommodate that. We understand I'm a realtor, and so I'm familiar with that. I also spent 5 years with Pleasant Grove Planning Commission, so I had a lot of these things came before us as well in the Planning Commission. And oftentimes, the things we looked at, and I'm sure you looked at the same thing, is the impact on neighborhoods and how it affects the neighbors and such. And this would absolutely have nothing until in there. So we consider, I would ask you to, as you have a discussion tonight, that you keep your mind open and look at that. And obviously, you still got to look at things case by case, I imagine, you know, property to property. But where it's not an impact in the neighborhood, that you modify your ordinance as such so that we can accommodate those type of properties that are not impacted there. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of give you my comments there, and if you have any questions, feel free to answer.
Thank you. Let's see, So we move on to, Corey, are you going to wait for the actual item you want to speak on?
Yeah.
It's up to you.
Let me just make a quick comment. I just want to thank you, Mayor, for the opportunity. Just want to draw attention for the council. Should you pass this resolution tonight, it's the intention of Representative Roberts to include all of the cities that that have passed that resolution to help craft the legislation that you'll be carrying in the upcoming legislative session. So we would hope that the city would take advantage of that and provide the feedback if necessary. Whether it's going to be mayor or whoever needs to designate for that opportunity.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Sessions.
Hi, Julie Sessions, 961 North Boulevard Turpin. And first of all, I want to thank you all for being here just to get away after dinner and trying to get back at this time of year is incredible. And I think that you guys do this continually for our city. I'm very grateful to you. Thank you. I have my concerns regarding Harvey Park, Park on Harvey Road, and in 2017, I texted Mayor Reese about my concerns, and she said to send them an email so I can forward them to the Parks and Trail Committee, as well as the staff, which I did in the beginning of 2018, and I was very grateful. I am certain that was forwarded on because that's the kind of person you are, but I did not receive a single response from anyone regarding any of my concerns, which I was quite disappointed about. I did not realize that we were already up for bids. I didn't realize the city had the funding for this park yet, or it would have been even more proactive. But one of the concerns I have is the place that the baseball field diamond is right now. My husband was playing a baseball game at the church on the Alpine Roundabout. There's a baseball field right there on the roundabout, and foul ball was hit and went through the windshield of a car, affected two women, and was quite a problem. And their state baseball diamond is not only tucked farther back, but it's facing the other direction. And they have very high fences, as high as behind the home plate, out all along where the roundabout is. And there's just a tiny area of small fence. I went and took pictures today, a very small area where the fence is shorter. But we not only have a lot of traffic going through there, but children and adults walking constantly. As much, I feel like, well, maybe not as much as on the walking path, but constantly. That there's people walking morning and night along that area, and kids home from school every single day, and things like that. So I'm very concerned about the safety of balls going there. It could be a tremendous problem for the city, and I really wanted these concerns to go on record, and I haven't received a response. But I also wanted to mention the noise. I don't know what the plan is with lights at nighttime and noise, because there are phones right there, and I have nine children, a two-year-old whose bed is literally right there, where windows straight across the street, and I wonder where that entrance is going to be into the where it's going to be directly across from the gates or a different place, and because there are homes right there. And we also obviously have a major problem parking, as we drove by Deerfield today. That's adding parking spots, but if people are parking on the streets as well, because it doesn't accommodate all the people that are coming with all those activities that are there, where I'm concerned that they won't, that there will continue to be parking there, which is always a danger as we're trying to come out of the gates and not seeing people, but also as children are walking home from school and things like that, and walking along there, I just am concerned because that road is extremely narrow to have people parking on either side.
Yes, I'm so sorry.
I thought there was like a 1 minute warning.
No, you're fine.
Thank you.
So we will make sure that we address all of those in our discussion tonight. And if you can't stick around, I'll take notes and email you.
I would really appreciate it.
Absolutely. That's okay. All right.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here tonight that wanted to provide public comment but is not on the sign-up sheet? Please.
My name's Rick Meinzer. I live across the street as well. And I'm excited about the idea of a park there, but the concerns that Julie expressed are legitimate concerns that I think we really do need to take under advisement. Just today, we had people parking literally at the gates for the school that was on it. I mean, it's a massive safety issue, and there's just no way that road, even if it's expanded, can handle the capacity. We did a big park in Highland. I'm a landscape contractor. And that drew so many people from outside the city to that park with the water feature and all the other enhancements that they offered that it was a massive parking challenge, and this just won't accommodate it. So I really think the city needs to think wisely about how we're going to manage parking. And I mean, I would recommend that there's one side of park, the R side if possible, that is a red zone where people can't park there or somehow some type of management. I know some of the city parks around here have no parking zones. The other thing that I'm really concerned about is just the amount of activity that would happen in that park in a nighttime environment. Those lights that I mean, I've seen the plans. Those are some significant lights that are specced out on those plans for the fields, and that light pollution is significant. I mean, it's gonna blow out a lot of homes in that area, and then it just invites people to come to that park at night. So I'm curious to see what the city's thoughts are. I'm hoping that's something that you might be open to cutting the lights, and they're not cheap as well. So those really are two main issues, and I think most of us in the neighborhood are in support of the park, but lighting, parking, and just the congestion in front of our neighborhood adjacent to that school is a pretty serious concern that we have. So anyways, thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Rick, what was your last name?
Rick Meinzer, M-E-I-N-Z-E-R.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Anyone else? Okay, we will close the public comment portion of our meeting and move on to the consent agenda, which has two items, the appointment of Tracy Lieberman and Annette Olson to the Family Festival of Community, and approval of the minutes from the November 20th work session and city council meeting. I do have one change on the minutes, Pauline. It's on page 5 of the meeting itself, under item number 13, which was the discussion on ranked choice voting. On that first paragraph, the second to last sentence, it says she explained there was no penalty for choosing to do ranked choice voting after January 1st. It should say to change her mind after January 1st. And then the second paragraph says the county clerk and lady power said she was in favor of ranked choice voting. It makes it sound like Amelia was here discussing it. I just want to make sure that that was to be part of my discussion there. Did anyone else have changes to this? Okay, then I will take a motion on the consent agenda.
I move that we approve the consent agenda.
That motion is made by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Seconded by Councilmember Anderson. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? We will move on to items 6 and 7, which are city reports and business, starting with Mr. Goodwin.
Yep. Some recreation notes. Our junior jazz has concluded signups right now. We have 1,139 participants. We're excited for that. It's the largest group we've ever had. And we appreciate the coordination with the local schools that allow us to do those programs. In conjunction with that program, we do sell junior jazz tickets to a jazz game. That is in the upcoming Portland Trailblazers game on January 21st. If you're interested in tickets, they're $22.50. They include a seat, popcorn, and a drink. So come to the city building and get those. The ski bus registration is now full, but we are taking registration for those who want to sign up and drive up separately from the bus. And the Vista Room has been extremely busy this December, and we anticipate the busiest January we've ever had to date. So those are all good things.
Chandler, can I correct you on one thing?
Please do.
They come here to the Recreation Center by the vouchers.
Oh, thank you. And then big thank you to the volunteer staff that worked on the Santa night and the Christmas decorations throughout the city. They look great. And finally, if you're looking for a last minute gift idea, feel free to stop by the pro shop and get something.
Thank you. Councilor Anderson.
Thank you.
So I just have one thing. I attended my Utah Valley Dispatch meeting this week, and all of the entities that feed into the dispatch have signed their interlocal agreements, so we are set to become now Utah Valley Dispatch and everyone. So that's exciting, because it includes some cities outside the county. So that's been done. And then Mayor Reese and I today attended the Utah County Commissioners Board meeting, and where they signed
into the law, the course of sales tax. So I think Mary's will probably talk about that a little bit more, but that's all I have to report. Thank you. Just as Councilor Anderson said, the county commissioners did approve the fourth quarter cent sales tax increase today. So we will, I already provide that information to Chandler, and we will recognize that in our fiscal year 2020 budget. And then, for those of you who are aware, the Utah County Commissioners and the Governor did come to an agreement on the UTA board seat. It is Kent Millington. So Utah County will now be represented in that lawsuit between the county and the Governor will go away, which is $15. Councilmember Miller.
I spoke with the Boyer Realtor at the Santa Night, and it was very well attended. He said there's about 25% more this year than the previous year. And it was an open suggestion, so if any community members or any members of the staff and council have input, I would do it. Boyer is open.
All right, thank you. We'll move on to item number 8, which is a review action on resolution stating that Cedarville's intention to participate in the municipal alternate voting methods pilot project, otherwise known as ranked choice voting. So just an update on that, and Mr. Holloway is here if the council has additional questions from our last presentation. But we have been informed that Provo, West Jordan, Lehigh, Salem, and Vineyard have all submitted their intent to do ranked choice voting next year. And as we talked last meeting, the city councils of each of those cities have until sometime in May to change their mind if for whatever reason during the legislative session we don't get funding that we need to help.
I think it's March.
I think it's May. Is it?
It's May 1st.
May 1st. So we have the opportunity to change our mind if we feel like it's not going to make sense for our city, we don't have the funding available. And as Corey mentioned, the representative who is overseeing this has indicated that he will work directly with the city to approve it to make sure that whatever funding that we're worried about is going to be requested in that bill. Mr. Bateman.
Yeah, I think we all understand how ranked choice voting works, what it is. Colton is informing me today that West Jordan passed their resolution for last night. It was last week, last Wednesday. And one of the concerns that they had was that Salt Lake County, Tooele County, Davis County, those counties' software, they just about said we're not capable of running an election with ranked choice voting. However, I think the story is a little bit different in Utah County with the number of communities down here that have adopted resolutions to proceed with ranked choice voting. Larger communities with Lehigh and I didn't know Provo.
Just today.
So Provo. So Lehigh and Provo, you have two of the bigger players in Utah County that are proceeding with their ranked choice voting this next municipal election. I won't say that staff does not have concerns because we do. And I'll just run through them really quickly. I don't believe that the concerns are with ranked choice voting itself. It's really more how the election is carried out. In this last election, we had even though it was mail-in ballots, we still that day had a line out the door the entire day. By the time we had to shut off the line, we still had 60 to 70 people in line.
More like 100.
Excuse me, 100. We had people here waiting to vote until about 11:30, and I think that is logistically is kind of problematic for us. But also, it changing the way we vote is interesting to follow. But our big concern from staff is what is the county going to do to educate people? The fact that they have larger communities, I think, puts some pressure on Utah County to get it right. They would have to put together pamphlets, mailers, informing people how to vote, how this works, how their vote is going to tally. But also those people that come in that day that have not done any of their own homework, there needs to be something put together for them as they stand in line, watch a 3-minute video, helping them to understand what they're going to see when they walk into the voting booth. So those, I think that's staff's big concern is the county, because Amelia Powers, the county reporter elect, has indicated that she's in favor of this, and I hope that by doing so that she's going to kind of take the role of the proverbial horns and
really, do a good job of educating the public. But that is staff's big concern, is that is the county going to do its part in getting software and getting the educational materials that need to be disseminated to the voters?
So what items on this next election would be eligible for?
We have three council seats that are open.
It's ranked as one of the only needs for a municipal election.
So right now it is that. So if we have four voters primary, I'm not at this point convinced that this would save money for Cedar Hills, just given the number of candidates we've had. We didn't even have a primary last election. So I don't think that should be the reason for switching. I think that there just needs to be something else. So I think that there's reasons for it. I think there's reasons against it, but I think that it's a very interesting premise to follow.
Do we have any other items that we know that will show up that are for statewide election on this ballot?
Yeah, they wouldn't be subject to ranked choice. It'd be for or against. Okay,
so,
but it'd really be only the council, the three council seats.
So it'll be a mixed ballot.
If there's even anything to vote on at a state level.
That's big. Yeah. We don't know what that is.
Yeah.
We don't know if there will be a referendum. We don't know yet.
So I like the idea of everybody's vote counting in one way or another, but the education part worries me. And like you said, the lines out the door. When you literally have the chance to pop that in your mailbox and you didn't have to wait until the last day, that kind of worries me. But as I said last meeting, we did the right choice voting in our caucus meeting and took 5 minutes of education. But I had everyone in a room and everybody had to listen, you know, they paid attention. And it went really smoothly. But so that worries me. The education part worries me. It's scary to be the guinea pig.
Yeah.
I'm on
the fence. Yes, I agree. And that's why I think that the withdrawal date is so important. I told a colleague this morning that if council passes this, I want on the April, we have one meeting in April, on that meeting, have a discussion on whether or not we need to pull out of the choice vote. I think that between now and then, if the city were to adopt it, then we need to coordinate with the county and see what efforts are being made between now and May. Kind of gauge their interest in their what they've done on their end. It's really it's on them to do that education.
Well, and so Amelia has said that she thinks that should be handled at the county level,
yeah.
But there's nothing preventing us in the city from also creating an education.
Which
we
should.
And we should, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And part of what, as Corey indicated, part of the money that can be available from this legislation that's coming through in January is providing funding for creating education. One of the things that I recommended was that for the cities that have implemented it, that we have additional help for poll workers on the day of election to help provide that education. You know, there are only 5 cities doing it, 6 cities doing it. That can be included in that grant.
Absolutely.
Other questions? And does anyone have questions for Corey while he's here?
As a side note, last time we talked about this, I brought up the issues in Maine, where some of those that have been ruled unconstitutional by, I think, their state election level, they actually had something in their constitution that specified the plurality of votes, so it wouldn't apply to us.
There is no further discussion, and I will take a motion.
I'll add a few comments.
Sure.
That's all right.
Absolutely.
That's My biggest concern is the education, like a lot of people share. I believe it or not, there were still a lot of people this past election complaining about mail voting, which is fairly straightforward, but there were still challenges. And some people feel like that's not even used to that yet. So I think education is a concern. We have a new clerk who has county clerk, and she hasn't been in office yet. She has ideas, but I don't know if she really knows yet what it would take to implement that. So it's encouraging her position, however. At this point, prior to taking office, is just kind of speaking, hopefully. Also, what concerns me is having mixed types of voting, so we get something caught on the same ballot. Again, we're going to have to communicate very clearly how things are done. I don't know. I'm hesitant. My inclination is to, I like it, and I think it will be appropriate, but my inclination is to let some other people test it out and see how it works for them.
Corey, do you know if, I know we have until the end of this year to notify the lieutenant governor's office. Do you know if cities will have an option again next year or how that works?
Yes, good question. The pilot is open until 2026. So every municipal election leading up to 2026 on the odd years, you'll have that option to be able to declare. If I could just respond to Councilman Miller's concerns. A couple of points that I want to make. One is, in the event that you don't have any council seats that that have more than two declaring candidacy, it's a regular election. It just goes to the general election. What this simply does is it would eliminate the need for the primary election. So the point that was made earlier, the cost savings, there would be no cost savings if there weren't a need for a primary. However, if there is a need for a primary, there'd be some cost savings associated with it. And then on top of that, related to a mixed ballot, I guess my response to that would be that the only mixed ballot, it would be just a yes or a no. The only ranking would be in those races where there are more than two candidates. So anyway, I hope that helps.
So I've studied this charter, this new method of voting, and I personally, I like the idea. But there again, I spent 30 minutes on YouTube and explained it, and it makes complete sense to me. However, as was mentioned, we have citizens that wait to the very last minute to try to figure out how to cast their ballot. And I was coming in to completely support this measure, but after listening to Denise and Brian, I don't have citizens knocking on the door, calling the phone, or ringing or emailing me saying this is what we want. And I think our citizens are still trying to grasp the concept of how we vote currently with the vote by mail, which I love the vote by mail as well. And to throw them another curveball like this, even though it's very simple to grasp once you grasp it, I don't think our citizens are ready for it, in my opinion. Just another curveball. I mean, we started with the mail-in ballots and now this and that. Personally, I love the idea, but like was mentioned, we have a line out the door for till what time? 11:30 at night.
That was typical across. Considering
that you had your ballot like 30 days before, and you could have just dropped it in the mail or dropped it off at, I can see that this is just going to cause some confusion I can just see groups of citizens just coming out and saying that's somehow rigged, or just because we haven't done it yet. There again, it makes complete sense to me. But I just foresee the city having to deal with some problems down the road until it gets out there and people are very aware of it, how it works and like that, so.
I think that as some of the larger cities in our community grow probably high, do it, there will be some exposure and some press coverage and talking about it, which our residents can be exposed to and kind of become familiar with the concept and hear of it. And then if we, you know, if it pans out well, say this next year in the pilot program, you know, they're generally satisfied and we can jump on it in the next cycle. Again, I mean, I think that at a certain point, it makes sense to implement this in that manner of voting, but I don't know about anything.
Well, I think that it's our straight way.
I would just to add to that, I actually have received feedback from residents both on Facebook and we did get some, I think they were actually council, some feedback through the city's website too, and most of the feedback that we received was supportive of it. I think whether we do it this year or 2 years or 4 years or whatever, it's going to be to our residents no matter when we do it. So there's going to be a learning curve whether it's now or 2 years from now, regardless of what any other city has done. If our residents haven't voted in that city election, it's going to be new to them. There's going to be challenges as you try it at some point. So I don't necessarily think that waiting and letting another city try it out benefits our residents in that it's still going to be something that they have to try. I definitely understand the concerns of the education component because my family hasn't particularly in it mentioned that you've done yet. As far as how the votes are tallied, that's just a software update, yeah. Which the software vendor has already said.
I think Utah County has also indicated that they can do that.
Yes, Utah County, the software, if it's Dominion that we use, the county uses Dominion. Dominion's already said it's a software update, that's not a hard thing to do. So the education component, I understand, is the concern. I guess I personally just have. I don't think it's going to be that hard for our residents to figure out. I know a lot of people are already doing it in caucus meeting, so it's not something completely out of the ordinary there.
It's not hard to figure out, but the citizen actually has to engage and educate themselves. And that, I think people may have responded to your, you know, to your Facebook page, are people that are involved and would take the time to figure it out beforehand, and then you're going to have a huge portion of the population is going to wait until election day to try and figure out how they're supposed to do this.
Right.
So,
One other thing is I don't like the idea of waiting for the county to educate our citizens because that never happened. We've heard what the governor has said about the elections in Utah County. We've witnessed, you know, elections here in Utah County. If we do move forward with this, I would propose that we would have city educate our residents.
If I can touch on that, I really like your point that you don't wait on the county, but this is something the city does before the city has internally. We have our own campaign because there are great resources. You can watch a 3 minute video and understand how request voting works. It's really good.
We can throw stuff on the website.
But I also think that coordinating with the other cities, Lehigh, Provo, Vineyard, Salem, that have adopted interest voting to work in conjunction with that, so that we're not all with our own educational materials, but we're working together. And also with the county.
Yeah. And that's something that money that's being requested from the legislature could be used for.
How long is that money available?
Well, that's the bill.
Well, it's going to be a one-time appropriation. So,
and that's my other concern is if we wait 2 years from now, if we need money to help us implement it, it may not longer be available. But that's, I mean, it's a risk of your
I'm in favor of it. I'm in favor of it if we start educating now. I don't think we can wait till May or June.
I think you start video pamphlets, links.
Yeah, in the water bill, put something in there.
Put it on the weekly updates.
Maybe even in the water bill, do a test. The election, there's something, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of things.
And again, if you decide to do this tonight, we've had to tell neighbors to say, we didn't get our education out, so now we're concerned. Or we heard from a lot of residents who don't like this idea and we're moving forward with it. The option's there to tell neighbors to say, never mind. But after tonight, we can't say yes, we want to do it. For this next election anyway.
And here's an idea, just floating that out on here. We could say yes tonight and have until beginning of May to back out. I think during, if we did that, we can use that time to take kind of a focus group of residents that are willing to spend just a few minutes one evening and get some feedback from them, have them figure out what is needed for them to be educated and see if, like, hey, is this going well? Maybe we might be able to do it. Just a small focus group and see just how it's received. And then, you know, feel like, oh, we can handle this. The actual practice of the voting is not difficult. It's to rank the people, you know, from first to worst, and how you want to do it. It's the how it's calculated that is. Takes a little bit more time for people to understand. But I'm open to that if we can kind of get a sense through some feedback on how this is going to be received during that time period.
Okay. Mr. Ray.
I've possibly been involved in too many Cedar Hills elections over the years. And one thing I've learned is when we have the election of 2019, there'll be three city council seats to fill. And so frequently people get terribly confused. You have the less informed voters who are like, well, do I vote for one? Well, I'm supposed to vote for three? How do I vote for three? Only one person can. I mean, there's always that confusion. Then you have like really educated people who are like, well, only vote for one or two because you want those people. Get through or don't vote for all three. So you have already this kind of game where people could, you know, face a ballot of like 10 or 11 candidates and they have to choose three. And they're already kind of partially overwhelmed because they don't understand, okay, for president I vote for one, for governor I vote for one, for mayor I vote for one. For city council it's already, you know, somewhat confusing. And so this ranked choice does definitely add another layer of confusion, but there's already substantial confusion in trying, wait, I'm supposed to rank because I vote for three, and the top three, like the third place person wins. I mean, I've seen that over the years. That was before we even had vote by mail. You only had like 20% of city voting. Now with 40% of the voting, I think you get even more, you know, kind of confusion when it goes to the council elections. So that's what I've seen, that's what I mentioned.
So you're saying confusion is just not a real deal.
That's what I tried to say. You said it.
I don't know if we eliminated by region until there's two seats, right, rather than three, or anything like that. But I just can't picture in my mind what the three seat ranked choice is. Like, do we assign people per seat to ranked persons per seat, or is it the top three?
Top three, or we have to get the 50%.
We don't have a representative district.
Yes.
Top three vote getters,
which we do already.
Yeah.
So what's the difference?
Yeah.
It's not. Most of them don't get 50%.
So with this, what would happen, just to be clear, is the electorate would make their selections, 1, 2, 3, whatever. And then if you've got three open seats, as you would, as somebody hits the 50% threshold, they're pulled off the ballot, and then it's recycled back through, and then as somebody else hits the 50% threshold, they're separated, and then it's recycled through, and then until you have three that have hit the 50% threshold. Does that help?
Yeah, I guess we would want to get three to hit 50%.
Well, there's no other way.
Yeah, it's always going to happen to the people.
Yeah.
All right.
So, I mean.
So I'm gonna weigh in on this.
Can I just add one other thing related to education resources? Where this has been done in other parts of the country, there is a ranked choice resource center that has resources that they can help cities with education as well. So
go ahead.
Just from my small study of it. Election occurred might be somewhere. I read about that one too. But I just don't think our residents are ready for more confusion. So that's what I said. Great question.
Okay. Any other feedback or questions? Not when I will do the motion. Oh, sorry, and just real quick, if you decide to make a motion supporting it, the request was made that we read it from the actual resolution because it does, I believe.
There's a second resolution that passed out today. Is somebody wanting to make a motion? I'll just hand you the resolution.
It incorporates, I think, the new part of it, which was that we have it until May 1st.
Yeah, it specifically called out the date, May 1st, in the resolution that's been updated.
Okay. So read that instead of what's on the panel.
Is anyone itching to make a resolution? Then we can make a resolution and vote yay or nay.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking.
Okay.
I'd like to make a motion that we adopt resolution number 2018-12-18A, a resolution of the City Council of Cedar Hills, Utah, adopting the ranked choice voting method and authorize the mayor to provide written notice to the lieutenant governor of the intent of the City of Cedar Hills to participate in the municipal alternative voting methods pilot project for the 2019 elections and authorizing the mayor and staff to take all their actions required for participation in the pilot project.
So, a motion by Councilmember Ellsworth. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Second by Councilmember Anderson. We'll open it up for discussion. Where is it? All right. So, the resolution. I'm going to take a roll call vote. Councilmember Yates.
Nay.
Councilmember Anderson.
Aye.
Councilmember Miller.
Nay.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Nay.
Councilmember Bailey.
Nay.
The motion fails. We will move on to item number 9, which is a review action on the Harvey Park Phase 1 bid award.
So we can talk about this, yeah.
This is the park concept, October 2017, we shared with the residents that we also had a 3D video. And we took their feedback then and got several comments right away, and most of it was thumbs up. We loved it. There were some people that said, hey, we want more of this or less of that, but most people realized it had a little bit of everything for everyone, and in the survey, the number one thing the residents asked for was a splash pad. So that was by far, it was twice as much what residents wanted more than another thing. So when we got the bids, it was for just a phase one. And before I go over that, let me explain phase one to the residents that are here and the council, if you're not aware. What phase one did was ask for all the landscaping as far as grass to be installed. And then as far as trees, just the trees that are surrounding this playground splash pad area, and then also these trees here and these trees here. And then every single shrub, Perennial was also included, except for the landscaping in the roundabout and the landscaping shrubs that are around a potentially phase two maintenance area. As far as amenities, restrooms, concessions, what it's called, pavilion was an option, and we also had three pickleball courts as in the base bid, and that was it, because parks are expensive. And then as alternatives, we had two tennis courts and the pavilions, or one pavilion, the cost of one pavilion as alternatives. So, we had one bid that we're excited about, because we think we can make it work for phase one. And it was by Keller Construction. There is an issue with an ordinance that I don't agree with, but good intentions at all.
Can I speak to that, Cheryl?
Yes.
The issue that Cheryl's talking about is the ordinance for a public building that is built that's over $400,000. The engineer's estimate of the building that we're talking about is the restroom concessions facility, and we estimated it to be about just under $200,000. Each of the bids came back with that building being $450,000 to $550,000, so substantially a lot more. So whomever we decide to go with, the city's going to need to re-engineer that building to get it under that threshold. We're not going to pay that much for a bathroom. So we're...
No roof,
yeah. So regardless of Keller or any other bid, that item needs to be renegotiated or re-engineered or redesigned in some way to get us under that threshold.
I know that you were having conversations with the bidders.
Yes.
And there was some confusion as to why everyone was so high.
It was a number of things. It was the structural concrete that was being designed. It was the steel frames. It was the method of construction. It was just a more expensive building than we had anticipated. And so I think that the bids were correct. I just think that there's ways to build that building that make it way more reasonable.
Yeah.
So we're gonna talk about that. That's kind of a small line item. However, because that on that side the building is a lot more than we had projected. There's a number of other line items that are very much under what we had projected as well. So it went both ways. In any case, the total bids for a couple of the submissions came back well within the engineer's estimate, which we were overall very pleased with.
Yes, so, and we interviewed with the engineers and the landscape company, the two lowest bids on Friday. And then I called several references on the lowest bid, and we have worked with the second lowest bid before, so we were familiar with them.
So I thought we adjusted that $400,000 for inflation and stuff.
It did, but it's still, with inflation, that from that day of inception of the ordinance, it still puts it like $435,000.
So we need to work to get under that amount. But in the recommendation is just to accept the contractor and then with conditional notice that we need to work with him on a couple items. And if you make that recommendation, I believe that as far as amenities go, this vendor has been willing to let the city use the park as soon as things go in, which is not, wasn't the case with all contractors, but the two lowest bids were more that way, where they're like, hey, we're not going to make kids stare at this for a year. So that is great. Our city can use it much sooner, even possibly this summer, some amenities. I wouldn't recommend holding soccer tournaments or anything, or flag football for until the warranty period's over, but I think it's okay for families to play on it. Things, but the playground and the splash pad would be really important since the restroom's done. So, as far as if we have a family festival there in a year and a half, we thought, we talked with Greg and Jeff and Chandler, and we thought we're going to need some shade. So, the 30 by 30 pavilion is almost like half the size of the Heritage Park pavilion. It's about, we're looking at it, it's about 30 by 50. And then it has lots of trees. So, it would be nice to have three pavilions. It would be nice to have all these amenities, but we can't fund all these amenities. So we're going to see what value engineering we can do. But this is kind of the tentative recommended priorities that we came with if we wanted, depending on what capacity. And the three funding sources, like I said at the last meeting, are street impact fees to widen the road. So they talked about the narrow road. The road will be widened, same width as the rest of the road. There will be slanted parking, not which changed from the initial drawing that showed parallel parking to make it easier. But also, if you notice, most of the high-level activities are farther into the park, which was a good design, so that there are going to be times when there's people parked in the road, like any good park, or if it's a terrible park, then you don't see cars parked at it, but this is going to be a good park, so yes, we hope there's lots of people that come. I'm sorry if that bothers people, but we want people to come. We don't want it to be boring.
Do you remember how many parking stalls there are on Harvey and in total?
Let's see. I want to say that there is 80 in this area, the narrow neck area. Oh, it says 90 stalls on this. And I believe there's around 40 in the street.
It's on one side of the street.
One side.
Yeah. So we're not planning on parking both sides of the street.
But I don't see a problem with painting the other side red.
Yeah. Can I touch on that, Charles?
Yeah.
Just to speak to some of the concerns, I wrote those down that Julie Sessions shared, and Rick, mine are the ones that you shared as well. The baseball field, we're not planning on putting the backstop up and putting the lights in, and that's not part of phase one. There's not a plan right now to do that. So as part of what we're approving tonight, we're not approving any sort of baseball field. So you won't see Little League tournaments down there later this year. It would be probably a number of years down the road. So I think that there's plenty of time for staff and council and mayor and local residents to have a nice conversation about your concerns and be able to resolve them and maybe work them out in a way that everybody wins here. That goes the same for parking. I would assume that I've gone down to the crossing guard down at Deerfield a number of times, and I'm assuming there's probably some Christmas program today that drew all the parents in, and that's just the way it is. I actually think that this park will alleviate some of that parking concern because there will be actual marked parking spots on the street, and not just a small amount. If you look at some of our other parks, the one across the street here, Mesquite Park, Heritage Park down in the center of town, I actually feel like they're horrendously underparked. Anytime we have an event at the city, whether it's the food truck rally, whether it's the family festival, soccer, we find that we have a number of parking issues. So in light of your concerns, in an effort to be sensitive to the neighbors around the park, we felt like we needed to overpark this compared to what we've done in the past. And then, like Charles said, I think that we can really have that discussion on painting the curb red on the other side of adjacent to your neighborhood as you pull out of as you pull out north onto Harvey from the park, just based on what we can see as a use there, and just kind of gauge that and have that conversation again with the neighborhood there, because we can be sensitive to that impact.
We did that
at the ski park because we found that people were parking on both sides of the street. Like I said, there wasn't parking internally to the park, and it created a safety issue, like Julie Sessions said, about kids darting in between cars and running out in the street and cars not having enough time to stop. Fortunately, we did not have any accidents, but it was something that the city responded to and painted the curb red to alleviate some of that parking concern there.
So just to clarify, there is no baseball field in phase one.
There is the right now there's the dirt.
Let me talk about it.
You're good.
Can I just ask a question on that though, real quick?
Sure.
So it's widened all the way through the park.
Yes.
But that water's property, is it going to evolve in that?
Yes. It does. And unfortunately that's because it enters Pleasant Grove. At that point, we've had discussions with the mayor of Pleasant Grove about possibly getting them to widen that road, to work with us on widening that road. But that's just kind of the nature of that neighborhood down there, is that you drive 5 minutes and you change jurisdictional boundaries six times.
So we need to decide, I mean, that the estimate we got from landscapers, we need to decide if we're going to put a backstop, because obviously if we have an infill, we probably should have a backstop. They estimated at $7,000. As far as lights go, that is a long ways away. It is very expensive, like you said, and that is the last phase, or whatever phase we do. But I think if you look at like tennis courts or football courts or that kind of thing, 90% of the play is when the lights are on, so if you only actually get utilized lights, and we can work on hopefully having lights that are not impacting residents as much. But I believe 5 to 10 years from now, there will be lights on the dock. But I, that will be a discussion in 5 or 10 years. We don't have money for lights right now.
What has been the policy for lights at the other parks? What time are they shutting off? I know that the park
we don't have the type of lights we're discussing. We don't have at any park.
So is it just at Family Festival?
Just
at Family
Festival.
The fire department reason?
Yeah. We don't have any lights. So when we're doing flag football out here in Mesquite Park, we have to coordinate those games so that at sunset, those games are wrapping up.
We can also time our splash pad and put it on a timer so that it only works at certain times. So yeah, I recommend it doesn't work after a certain period of time. I don't think we necessarily want kids on the playground after dark, but I don't know, but that's not funded in this phase, and so that's a discussion in like a third or fourth phase.
Are you speaking about the baseball field or the lights?
All the lights. Okay. All the lights. Baseball diamond, I could see us putting in a backstop up just for safety for the cars. Because someone, even if we don't have official tournaments, I don't think people are going to come for one field to run a tournament. It's going to be like your ward softball game or something. I mean, there might be some games there, but we probably need a backstop to protect the cars.
The only recreation leagues that the city holds that are baseball related are T-ball, and we do that at Heisel-Talo, and we would use this field as well.
That's what Burgess Park now.
And anyone that wanted like official teams, they'd have to run it through the city. I don't know if we give approval for.
We right now we coordinate with a local Lone Peak Youth Baseball for Heisel-Talo, because it's a groomed field. It's got a fence. It's got distances. It's got it's maintained as a baseball field.
But
this one,
youth,
they're all youth, yeah.
I think our concern would be
sorry, direction.
Can you just come up to the microphone?
Direction. And the direction of the tennis courts and everything is the industry standard, so that the lighting is
I think
in
she's
your
talking
place.
About the way that the baseballs base are hit out towards Harvey.
I know. And
so
I'm
what's the distance?
That's the they're facing every field's facing a certain way because that's preferred way, but
preferred by
who? Preferred.
No, it's because he's making a valid point. The point is, when you play softball in the evenings as the sun's going down, you don't want that pitch coming into your face.
Right.
And so they always pitch them so you've got the sun going the other direction.
It's a substantial distance as well from home plate to the road. It would have to be a good hit. I know they happen, but it comes with the baseball field as well.
It's all solvable with various different things. And when we get to that phase where we're actually really missing out, we address that. I also we need additional fence to catch it. Well, hit the baseball, we can do it. We need netting that goes down the baseline. Let's look at it.
Right.
All this stuff is solvable.
We were just trying to have. I mean, originally, if you look at the concept 10 years ago, I think there was like 3 baseball diamonds.
4.
So we cut back quite a bit based on there was other amenities that the residents wanted. But we're trying to do a well-balanced park so that some people really want a place. There's no place right now in Cedar Hills where they can play softball.
So I will, I will open it up for public comment as soon as we're done, but we do have to follow correct.
That's owned by the city as far as I know.
There's one. The high school football.
The high school for the girls?
No. We changed our baseball field to be a softball field as well.
Okay. Is that for adults?
It's a pretty short field.
Yeah,
it's a youth field.
It's not designed for adults.
No, it's not.
For
it's for youth.
So, there you go.
All
right. So, let me talk a little bit about the funding. On the impact fees, we have plenty of street widening impact fees for any contingencies that may come with that street. We have around $600,000, and I think the bid was in the $300,000. On the and then also, I'm going to talk a little bit later on budget amendments, but we have right now, just so you know, I did not allocate, I'm not recommending spending every single dollar on the other funding sources. I'm planning on there being still approximately $1.2 million in water sewer fund after this, and $400,000 in capital projects fund after whatever we select. So that's my recommendation for contingencies.
Any questions for Mr. Lowe?
Did I mishear you? Because I thought you said in the first phase there's 3 pickleball courts, but up there you show 4 pickleball courts.
So in our, so what we're trying to do, because is originally we weren't going to have pickleball lines on the tennis courts, but to serve the people that want tennis and pickleball. We found a good example in Vineyard where they did lines like this that aren't obnoxious and they're tasteful. And so we were going to paint 4 pickleball courts on the 2 tennis ball courts. And so it's $100 on Amazon to buy a pickleball net, or you can rent one from the city almost for free. So.
Thank you.
Sure. Any additional questions for Shara? Chandler, do you have anything else that you wanted to add?
No, I think that we've gotten a number of resident emails one way or another. Like this last week, we got a couple on the pickleball courts. But if you go back through the history of the park where Charles has solicited feedback over the course of the last 2 years, there hasn't been that big of an outcry for pickleball. So I think that we're trying to accommodate various groups of people in the city by having the tennis court slash pickleball court. But also I think that from a staff's perspective, our goal is to have to be able to host the 2020 Family Festival in this park. We'd like to move this to be the center of our events, the center of our city celebration. And so we need to be able to prepare for that. And so there's not going to be shade down there. And that's why the pavilion has become a little bit more of a priority over some of these other amenities, because we feel like that serves the greater community rather than pickleball court serves a small niche of the community.
Also, if we go through the process and there's not a lot of change orders, then we can say, okay, yeah, we can fund these pickleball courts. Oh, we also sold a few houses in the Cedar Canyon development. We have some impact fees now to help pay for some of these things. So this is just a starting point. We'll reevaluate it as that, you know, maybe we can get some more pickleball courts within the year.
So I'm new to pickleball and I played it a few times. It's a lot of fun. So it's I agree with some of the emails. A great kind of a family thing. I mean, my wife and I have done it. It's fun. If you haven't done it, you have a drive. But I feel like some of the special interest in this is all concerned that the city's going to make money on these big pickleball tournaments and stuff that I don't think that's our goal.
Yeah.
I don't think we just want to supply some nice courts for our neighborhood. I don't care about tournaments. I honestly don't care about hosting a pickleball tournament. There's 26 going in Island right now. They can host it over there.
Yeah, I agree.
And I'm not to offend the people that want to have a pickleball tournament there, but I'm saying I don't think that's the purpose of our park. I don't think that's ever been the purpose of our park.
We talked about this earlier. It's our last park, so we're trying to accommodate as much as we can in our last remaining open space.
I agree.
All right, Council, I'm going to go ahead and open it back up to public comment. So if there are any residents who would like to make a comment, I just need to come up to the microphone and state your name, and you're welcome to share your thoughts.
My name is Melissa Walker. My concern is the direction of the baseball field that we have right there. I play softball, I play baseball, have my whole life. There are many fields that there are four fields all facing a different direction. It's possible to change the direction of the field. My concern is that home run area is facing our parking and our street, which goes where the cars are, goes where the kids are. I think we can find a better solution to it than the direction it's coming. I don't have anything against having it. In fact, I'm excited about it. But if we can rectify that, I think it would be a lot smarter idea. And I don't think it would be expensive to change that.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Okay. So we'll go back to the council for discussion. I'm sorry, I'm seeing Chandler that flipping it, so that way...
No, honestly, if flipping it, if I can just be frank, flipping it at this point is not easy, and I'll tell you why, because believe it or not, the grades on that park change dramatically. They're scalping 6 inches off the top of that park and having to reallocate it to smooth it out so that we can have fields. So it's really not as simple as just turning it. I know on this illustrative plan here, it looks like it's simple, but I really don't believe that's the case, especially where we've already paid to have it engineered. I was going to say the same thing. If anything, I would say our recreation programs demand football and soccer and t-ball, and you can even play t-ball on grass. My kid does. I would say that before we go through the song and dance of rotating that softball field or the baseball field, that we just for right now forego it.
Well, the other option would be if, as Councilor Ellsworth said, there was some way to put up netting or such. I know we couldn't afford to do that in phase one. Maybe we just not put that in phase one until we can afford to put in whatever protective barrier we could have done.
And I would go that route before I went to going back to the engineers to say, let's rotate this.
We would have just started with grass, but because the landscape architect had all his plans for a dirt infill, it was going to cost us more to have him switch the plan and then rip it out and then do it again. And so we were trying to save money just by having whatever was going to be there in the long run installed, so we wouldn't have to reduce from where should we do the dirt. All that. We didn't want to have to say, why didn't we do this in the first place?
Yeah, I would say though that this, if it's a major concern, I would say forego the dirt, just put in grass right now, and until there's a reasonable solution that everyone can agree to, just make it grass.
Well, and also for the family festival, isn't it more useful to just have a bunch of grass?
I am okay. The original park had several baseball fields, so we were just trying to accommodate everyone that had an interest, not just certain groups.
In that survey, was baseball fields high up there?
Playing fields and baseball fields were both low.
Yeah. So, the soccer fields and the football fields were.
Do you know what the dimension is?
The splash pad and the courts and the playground were more important.
Councilmember Anderson, you asked why we have two soccer fields. That's more, rather than, there's not a demand for household use of the soccer field, but there is a demand for our recreational program. So your family's not going to go look for a soccer field, but for our recreational programs, we're short of space.
Well, and to be fair, I think one of the reasons why they were thinking about putting one there is that right now we do have some conflict with the and Councilor Bailey can answer this better than I can, but we do have conflict with scheduling two baseball or softball fields that we have. It seems that we have a hard time coordinating with groups that want to use those. And so I think that's part of the reason for looking at it is having at least one location.
Just roughly or quickly, do you know what the dimension down the left field line is to the end there? From home plate to the trees.
The engineers
don't have it. Can you flip flop the baseball field and the soccer field? Is that too much trouble?
No, we need to build it, sir.
No, we asked that. It goes down like 20 something feet from the road to the.
Yeah, there's more slope than you think there is in that.
Yeah, there's major slopes, and there's lots of slopes just to the edge. I mean, not right to the edge of that soccer field, but pretty close. There's some dramatic slopes that were going to be storm drain basins, but we were like, no, we can't have storm drain basins there. But they're still sloped way more than you want for a field. And to pay the engineer, they can't do that without taking the circle out and totally, then you don't have a place to turn around. So, we can bring up with the contractor, see what solutions he has that don't cost money that much, but we'll see what he says. I don't want to not be able to do a pavilion because we did a change order on slope.
Right,
yeah.
It'd be better just to cut it out.
I'm thinking that I'd rather go alongside of safety first, even with the baseball that I'm building, I'd rather see all the safety features put in than take out, since it's been raised up. It makes sense. I've seen even kids' games all go flying in the cars and some of the other parks. Until those trees are big enough, that they don't provide any shelter from the stray ball. I would have that on the back burner, on another phase, so we can do a little more studies.
Any other questions or feedback for staff?
I did have one question, and I know this is going to be discussed later phase, but the lighting, we talked about, we have curfews for the parks. Is the idea to have the lighting be synced up with those curfews? Really could it play at a certain time to minimize the light pollution and noise for the residents there?
Yeah, they would have to be synced up to rec programs. I don't believe we would just leave them on all the time. I don't think the city's going to shoulder that cost. However, a lot of the, that's for like the baseball diamond or a soccer field, a football field.
Right.
But for the tennis courts, pickleball courts, a lot of times those ones have a timer on them that you can self-regulate. So I'm going to be here for the next 30 minutes. I can turn it on. But you do want to control the light pollution so that it stays on the court and doesn't spill out into the adjacent neighborhoods.
There's going to be new street lighting, so.
And I would say have a timer on it, like the splash park. If we don't want people in our park, like, don't let it just hurt their view. Don't let them come on the light.
The light that they're going to see the most is the new street lighting that will be all night. I mean, honestly. I mean, that's just.
But that's
normal for streets.
Like,
yeah. It will be the same street lights that are on the rest of the street.
All right, council, I will take a motion, and just with the note that whatever motion you make, make sure that you include changes that you want to keep for phase one.
Right now, is that baseball diamond basically?
That you did except for the lights.
Yeah, lights aren't in phase one.
There's no lights. In the bid, there was no backstop. It was just the.
What other changes?
The other thing we need to probably talk about, if we're not going to do that, is are we going to do all the concrete work? Let me. Around the diamond.
I mean, even without lights, if you put the dirt there and the concrete work there, people are going to play with it. Whether we have the rest of the features or not.
Yeah, I would only put in concrete to support the pavilion and the walkway to that pavilion.
Is that what you think?
So my recommendation is, if you don't want people playing baseball there, don't put the dirt there.
We just have to make sure. It's not as easy as just say cut this out with the bit. You said we can't just cut things out because we need certain items might have a price to them, and so we can cut it out, but we might not have significant savings. It's fine.
I'm a public contractor, so.
Sorry, I just need you to come up to the microphone and state your name.
Justin Marshall, on Holland Harbor Boulevard. I was the second contractor, just so you know. But from a resident's point of view, the concrete and the baseball diamond itself can be removed very easily. The sand is an expensive type of sand. It's over $100, shipped in special. And so if you're doing that for little kids to play on, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So if you're just going to say it's a little kid field, you may as well just go to sod. And all you're adjusting with that would be sprinklers. And the cost of that field is approximately $20,000 just in specialty sand. So if it's not going to be good use for baseball, you may as well turn it into grass for little kids to play on. And the concrete is a line item bid, and per contractually, you can eliminate it at a unit cost. So just flip it and move the grades, yes, and just take those out and just save money for the city. I think that's also is usually okay.
I think that if we're going to take that ball field out, then we've got a huge space there that maybe we just need to have the draftsman just replay everything out of it. Because all it's
going to
be is like a grass field.
I don't think it's worth going through the draftsman process and having them and redo it. But I do think that it is worth having the discussion with the whoever's awarded the contract to go say we want this many square feet of concrete removed. And then adjusting it appropriately, as well as the dirt. The dirt should be easy because we were going to put that one in as an isolated irrigation zone, so that it, this was the original plan, it was going to be grass. We just decided let's forego the grass and put the dirt in now, but we can go back to that original plan.
It was also, it doesn't show it on here, but all the area above infield was designed that you could have multi-purpose fields. So there would be, so.
So like you laid out soccer.
So all this area right here, we were counting on flag football and soccer world that we played on there. So I don't think there's major adjustments needed if that's what this purpose is going forward. And if City wants to do something crazy in 10 years, they can do that too. I don't think we need a huge adjustment to it. I think we can just tell him to take it out and see where he says.
Yeah.
So I can go ahead and make a motion for this. I'll go ahead and make a motion to award the bid for general contracting services to Keller and to authorize mayor and city staff to negotiate and sign a contract based on the provisions outlined in the bid proposal, plus what we discussed tonight with regards to removing the additional concrete and the dirt for the baseball diamond, and leaving on top of this initial proposal.
All right, I have a motion made by Councilor Ellsworth. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Second by Councilmember Geddes. Councilmember Bailey.
Nay.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Anderson.
Aye.
Councilmember Geddes.
Aye.
Motion passes. We will move on to item number 10, which is a discussion on the Cedar Hills Park Master Plan. They've been working hard. They've done a great job putting this document together, and I recommend you read the recommendations for each page. It's at the 90% plan right now. Based on the latest bids, I think some of the numbers in the back are low, and the time schedule is a little aggressive. I don't think it will happen that fast, but the recommendations are still good. So, there is an inventory analysis for every single little dinky park and mid-sized park and everything in here. And so there's recommended places like for Cedar Run where trees could help it. They've noticed where there's concrete damage, where there needs to be wood chips or whatever. Whatever needs to be updated. Sunset Park also has tree planting recommendations. The biggest changes, we asked them to focus on heritage and mesquite because of the high use they get. And so the goal of this park in the long term is to make it more usable. So there's a pavilion closer to the parking, there's additional parking, there's ADA connections, and there's different things. There's also a phased tree replacement plan. So the concept basically is one year you have an arborist go through and
maybe this is in 5 years. Right now we have arborist pruning, trying to keep the trees healthy, but these trees do not last forever. And eventually they have to be replaced. So take one third of the most unhealthy trees out and plant new trees in their place. And then in a few years after that, you would take other trees out, plant new trees in their place. And so that's kind of the idea behind that. And a lot of the Parks Committee can discuss what trees they want to plant or want to recommend for these areas, but that's the biggest changes. Heritage Park, and then on Mesquite, you can see they added quite a few trees. They recommend expanding the pavilion and as been said, some pretty basic things that would make it a better park, add a water fountain, add a bike rack, some basic stuff. But they went through each park, so you can go to your neighborhood and see what they recommended for your neighborhood in this park. And I think they did a very thorough job. And then at the very end, there's a trail map, shows the connectivity of all our trails, and it also has recommendations for some gaps to fill. And open space map, we have open space, recommendations for signage, where we could put it, kind of signs we might want to put at different locations. And then there's estimates for each park for the recommendations. And I think there's a nice list here. And then at the very end, they kind of list the priority of what parks need help first. I think the timeline is way too fast. But you guys have any feedback for insight? They want to have this finalized soon with your approval and give us a long-term plan.
When they say soon, what are they expecting?
I think they wanted to let you review a 95% plan at the budget retreat.
Okay. That would be good, because the council just got this on Friday, so obviously you have time to go through.
Yeah, a month or so.
So we'll plan on discussing that further at our retreat, if the council can go through that before then.
Well, we have, I'm trying to figure out maybe cost estimates in here.
Yeah. Page. See right here, there's the park, and then it lists, it's towards the end, 17 and 18, I think, for the park.
They're down by line item and total by each park.
I think most of them are close. I think the pavilion costs a little bit.
Any comments on this? We will plan on having that as an item on our retreat in January. Anything else from you, Mr. Lowell?
No.
Okay. That was a discussion item only, so we'll move on to item number 11, which is a review action on and public hearing on a resolution adopting fiscal year 2019 budget amendments. We will do the presentation and then hold a public hearing right after that.
Okay. I mentioned this earlier, but for the capital projects, we're adjusting up to $800,000 to make it available for the park and for storm drain improvements and the related infrastructure, $725,000, which is an update. We have good news. Yesterday, our Cottonwood Rail is running the best it has. A long time. Jeff's not here, but he was the one that told me. And so we have a project for Cottonwood Well, but it looks planned, but that looks like it's needed anymore, so that's good news. Other future items, including possibly secondary meters in the future, but we feel like we can still phase that with this funding.
Which one's Cottonwood again? Is it the new one?
It's the newer one.
On the trail?
Yes.
That's really good news. I mean, I'm really happy about that.
Yeah. Any questions for Cheryl on that? All right, we have noticed a public hearing for that, so is there anyone here who wanted to provide comment through the public hearing for this item? Please.
I was just wondering, are you going to be able to propose
budget? Sorry, I see you have to put the microphone, but she's got it recorded.
Rick Meinzer, is there a proposed budget for the park that we're going to be able to see?
Yes, it's. Make that bigger, Cheryl. So.
For phase one, I guess,
yes.
What you're proposing. Phase one is approximately $4 million.
For
$3 million, this contractor.
And what was it? Is the park, is the land acquired and purchased in that debt service?
Yes. No, it wasn't acquired with debt service. It was acquired with funds that we had.
Okay, so the park is paid for. Right. So it's a $4 million proposal for this park. Phase one.
And just to clarify on that, some of that money is coming from, we had purchased the land that's currently on North County Boulevard that we sold recently. Some of the money that was utilized to purchase that land was specifically for park acquisition, park development impact fees that we're now utilizing on Harvey Park. Some of it is impact fees for road improvements. So we have impact fees still for streets. We can only use for streets, that will be used to widen Harvey Boulevard. We have some impact fees still in our water and sewer fund that will go to implement that infrastructure. So it's coming from multiple accounts, some of it impact fees, some of our reserves. Any other public comments? Okay, I will close the public hearing then, put it back to the council. If you don't have any other questions for Charo, then I will take a motion.
I will make a motion that we adopt resolution number 12-18-2018B, the resolution adopting the amended 2018-2019 fiscal year budget for the year for the city of Cedar Hill.
Motion made by Councilmember Anderson. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Ellsworth. Councilmember Bailey.
Aye.
Councilmember, no, sorry, that was not seconded by Councilmember Miller. Sorry. Councilmember Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Anderson.
Aye.
Councilmember Gibbs.
Aye.
That motion passes. We'll move on to item number 12, which is a discussion on business licensing and home occupations.
All right. So this is just a discussion tonight. As Mr. Richards indicated in the public comment, he did approach the city about his client, Joe Wilkins, who was a resident of the city, building a building and using a portion of that building, not the entirety of the building, as part of his business. And currently under city code, business license code, we don't allow for home occupation businesses to be operated in that certain areas. Those are accessory buildings, garages, carports, breezeways, yard space, or areas for storage of material in the province. We have limited where you can operate your business, but that begs the question, and this is what I ask staff, is how much should we actually care about some of this stuff? There are parts that we still care about. We don't want people putting up a carport next to their home and operating a business or that. We want the same thing for a breezeway between buildings. Garages are meant for cars, not for businesses. We want part of our home code requires two garage parking stalls. We want to make sure they're really maintained. And same thing with yard space. We don't want people storing materials outside. It's just coming for a neighborhood. However, the accessory building is a little bit different, I feel. And we had some back and forth with staff, and I don't know that there's a total agreement on what I'm about to say, but from my perspective is, how much do we care if they're operating a business out of their accessory
discussing it with staff, there are areas where we would care. And so there would have to be some sort of litmus test that is established that will, or some criteria that would have to be met in order for an accessory building to be used for business purposes. And so let me ask three questions that could be proposed to you. Is how will the changes affect others around you? You're putting in this building, or you have this building, and you're operating a business. What is the impact on your neighbors? What is that detrimental impact? And then can it be mitigated? So I think if you can look at that and say, there really is no impact, then what are you mitigating? Almost nothing. State business licensing code changed 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, to where cities could no longer charge business license fees for business, home occupation businesses that had no off-site impact. And staff, we had many discussions about what it meant to have an off-site impact. And we determined that if somebody comes to your house, there is an impact there, but it's gotta be a material off-site impact, is what the state code says. And so if somebody just one off coming to your house, let's say that you run a salon or a barbershop out of your basement, and you have three clients a day that come three different times, there's really no measurable impact there on the neighborhood. It's no different than the number of just a couple of people visiting you throughout the course of the day. However, a business that would have a measurable offsite impact would be a preschool or a daycare where at 3 o'clock, you know, you have 15 cars lining up, clogging the roads, and then 15 minutes later leaving, and then an hour later coming back and picking up their kids. So that'd be like a dance studio would have a significant offsite impact on the neighborhood. So what we're kind of discussing and changing this code is that under the Article B is 3-1B-1, it's the requirements and conditions of the home occupation, to strike out the provision that home accessory buildings cannot be used for business purposes.
Which item is that?
It's A. So 3-1B-1, it's A2. Here it says the home occupation shall be conducted entirely within the living area of the dwelling and shall not be visible from outside of the structure. You see there it starts listing those areas where it's prohibited, and an accessory building is listed there. My proposal is to discuss striking that out to allow for accessory buildings to be used for home occupation businesses. Second area I think needs to be addressed is on number 8. It says the home occupation shall occupy an area of not more than 25% of the total living area, or 600 square feet, whichever is less. Looking at some other communities, they limit it to 1,000 square feet and 35%. So I think there's probably some room to maybe adjust that a little bit. And then,
real quick on that one. Yeah. Are you adding the whole thing in the accessory structure you did to get your percentage?
Or is that just that?
It's just an area of, like, well, area of either dwelling that is used. Right now, there's no provision, yeah. But right now, it's just, it would be interpreted as any area that's used for the business.
And so we're taking out of how that can be gotten around. I guess if we did 1,000 square feet, that would probably count that out for us. But,
yeah. And then, if this were to be adopted, I could add a provision on specifically on how this impacts accessory buildings. I would make them make sure that, that they've obtained a building permit for the building. The building has a certificate of occupancy. The building is located entirely in rear setback areas. The buildings comply with all zoning requirements of the underlying zone. There's no change to the residential nature of the dwelling. But also, I think that there should be a provision that any any business that's occupied, any business that's run from an accessory building has no measurable offsite impact. So, if, for example, you have two built businesses in Cedar Hills that are considered home occupation businesses that operate out of accessory buildings, and they're run as a premises occupation. There are Shelley School of Irish Dance on Canyon Road, and then just a little bit further south is Eddie's Bike Bar. Both of those meet the code as it relates to premises occupations, which is a little different. You can run a business when you're adjacent to an arterial road, which is Canyon Road. In the case of Mr. Wilkins, he's on just a normal residential road, so he doesn't meet that provision. However, where his photography business would likely have no measurable offsite impact, I'm assuming, where you would have the same situation as the salon, where you have a number of people coming occasionally, but probably not large groups of people all at the same time. There's not really an offsite impact. So as long as there's not an offsite impact, you could run your business. Now, once there's an offsite impact, then you need to meet the premises occupation code, similar to what Shelley School of Dance has met and Eddie's Bike Bar as well.
So I have a question on that. We currently allow dance studios and daycares and preschools in residential zones, and there is an offsite impact for that. So why would we care that there's an offsite impact for an accessory unit but not for the main unit?
That's a good question. This is just one way the staff, like myself, is in this category, preserving the residential status of the unit. It becomes a lot easier to run a business when you can run out of your accessory building. And so we just want to make sure that, I mean, that can change, and we can talk about that. That was just one way to mitigate the concern that these types of businesses would change the nature of the neighborhood. So if you limit it to businesses that do not create an offsite impact, then you're preserving that residential nature.
I guess my only concern with that is that we don't already have that requirement for your main. I mean, we have quite a few preschools in our city, so I guess I don't understand the mentality of it's okay for you, but not okay for Mr. Robinson's accessory unit on a much larger lot. Why do we care?
You're taking his example is he's living on a 2-acre lot. So you got to apply that to everyone in the city. So you can have people that are on a 3-acre lot and they put an accessory building and then they run a business out of it, and they have an impact, then it starts to impact the neighborhood. I agree, is that he could have an offsite impact and not impact the neighborhood.
True.
But yeah, I think you've got to look at the greater neighborhood and say, the greater city, the greater community, and say, how is this going to impact throughout the community, rather than just building.
I agree with that. But I'm saying, if we're worried about that, then why wouldn't we change the ordinance and say, nobody can have that negative impact, including your main dwelling?
I think you'd be violating state code at that point. Because you can have, the state code does allow you to have a home occupation business that does have an offsite impact. It's just for limiting that. And so that's a discussion. If the council's okay with that, if the council's comfortable with that, we can pursue it in that direction. I was just throwing this out there as a compromise too. Because when I brought this concern up with staff, the number one concern was, how is that going to change the nature of the neighborhood?
And I know in the same area we've allowed a home owner to use their home as a reception center, which has a considerable impact. Mm-hmm. And we've allowed it. But I guess I just.
And there's
like
issues there where they didn't, they haven't completely complied right. with everything that staff was required.
So Council, my, for what it's worth, John and I already talked about this a few times, and my feedback tends to be let us enforce our nuisance ordinances. So we don't allow overnight parking in the winter. We have a noise ordinance. We have certain things to protect the integrity of neighborhoods and to protect property rights for neighbors. I think we can continue to enforce those and require those, but still be lenient with allowing residents to do what they can on their property. And another aspect that I'm looking from that is, and we talk about this a ton, we are really being hammered by the state that we need to have affordable housing in all of our community. And I see this also as another opportunity for us to say, we're making it easier for our residents to generate income from their home, making it easier for them to then stay in their home as their circumstances change, whatever the case may be. So my question is, do we care if we are enforcing our nuisance ordinances and making sure that you're complying with those? Do we care what you're doing on your property? And if we do, maybe it's a conditional use.
Let me throw this out too. South Jordan, what they've done, and this might be a way to get between what I was presenting and kind of what your sentiments are there. South Jordan, they just went ahead and listed a list of prohibited businesses that you can't operate out of a home occupation. And so that's a method that you can do as well, saying, look, we are not going to allow you to run a kennel out of your home. The second thing that they've done that could kind of establish a bar is they've limited the number of trips, one-way trips, that the business generates, which saying, in order to preserve that residential nature, we're going to limit you to 12 trips. I think the number was 12 one-way trips. So if you want to have a dance studio, that limits the number of students that you can have. You can have your dance studio, you just have to fit it within the confines of this traffic impact. It would be the same thing on any business. So there's ways to maybe to set a bar without allowing them to still do what they want to do.
Jim, how's the bicycle bar? Isn't that a separate building?
Yeah, it is. That doesn't fall under this. This falls under this Article E, which is premises occupations. So there, on this one, it's A2 here. It says a lot which the premises occupations conducted shall have an area of not less than 1.5 acre. The owner is occupied by the owner of the premises occupation and be adjacent to and have ingress and egress to an arterial road. So a long canyon road.
That's an arterial road.
It's an arterial road. So it's kind of a different test that they're
doing. Yeah. So I concur with what the mayor said. I see no issue with this at all. If someone can legally build an accessory building according to our code, I really don't care what they do. I mean, obviously.
Yeah.
As long as it's, but let them have, yeah, let them have a dance studio, or let them, yes, I the off-siting act, that I'm not in favor of that, but they're given state code. But I don't see any reason why we shouldn't amend what's been talked about. I mean, that's their property. It's legal to build an accessory building. Yeah, that's my
hope. I agree with her with what you're sharing. I just think that the discussion at least needs to be had that this will impact neighborhoods. How much do you care about that?
How many people are in
that? That's the point. Is that under the proposal that Mr. Wilkins has is I don't even think this applies to him. It's the neighbor next to him that wants to run a dance studio that hosts two classes at a time, and each class has 20 students, and they have two dance classes.
That's when we get into what the mayor mentioned was the nuisance ordinance.
But they still wouldn't violate any nuisances.
Which is right. Correct, but I mean, I moved to another part of the city recently, but in the neighborhood that I lived in previously, which she was local mayor of, that street I lived on always had numerous cars parked just because of the number of teenagers who now have multiple vehicles and not enough parking. And so we allow that. Why would we care if someone's doing that for photography but not multiple cars just parked there all the time because there's not enough parking for all of the people living on that street any longer?
We do get complaints on that though.
I know, but we can't.
There's nothing we can do about it.
So, I mean, we could make an ordinance that you can't park on the street. I don't think we want to, but that's what I'm saying is, do we look at just enforcing nuisances or updating our nuisances ordinance to accommodate those?
I agree. If we have an issue with nuisances, then let's address the nuisance problem.
So based on what I'm hearing, there's really no concern that if the business has an outside impact or not.
I'm fine that you're doing like you said, having exclude certain things. I mean, we don't want hazardous materials being produced on your property. We don't want
constant noise or something like that.
Which we have a noise ordinance, even in the day. If it's loud, you can't do that. So maybe we specify those kinds of things. But
yeah, I would call those things out in maybe the times with different zones that we have, that certain zones can support things better than others. The Cedars cannot support a very active business, or is Mother Nature just good? So.
Well, of course, the HOA has their own rules.
They have their own rules, and they're very limited. I mean, it's get your neighbor's approval, and you're good.
Yeah. I mean, my daughter went to preschool in your HOA, and so there were four times a day where there were a lot of cars on that particular street, but it's 10 minutes.
And they worked it out with the neighbors, but it was okay. Right. So.
But the neighbors will let you know if they're
happy. Yes, and a lot of
stuff. Yeah, and they may not directly let you know. It may be calling up.
Yeah.
These guys will send code enforcement out. They'll let them know when they're sick.
And I think people are having to get more creative with the way they earn a living. The economic situation is changing, and people need to get creative. And I know a lot of people who have had to bring business home. So I think we need to accommodate our residents who need to do that. And some of them have to operate a business that they can't do out of just an office or a room in their home. They need a little more space.
To that end, just like update you on an interesting conversation I had with Mr. Wright, in that our code was drafted 20, 25 years ago, when the main purpose of somebody operating a business out of their home was typically to manufacture something and sell it. Our economy has shifted so much so that it's no longer a production economy, it's a services economy. And so now you're doing web design out of your house, or you're doing photography, or you're doing something that really, you're not, we had one person that wanted to pack Rolex, we didn't want to do that, just because they had to store so much gunpowder outside. The whole, there's been a shift in what people do as far as a home-based business is concerned. So that's why I think that it minimizes the impact.
I'm in favor of expanding personal property rights within reason. I mean, there are some things that you mentioned that you don't want to have, but in the case of Target Studio, there's no reason why you shouldn't allow something similar. It's just fashioning. Where is the limit?
Yeah. Well, as a city council, you guys need to establish the limits.
Mr. Wilkins or Mr. Richards, is there anything that you wanted to add?
Sure.
I just need you to stay with your name.
My name is Joseph Wilkins. So I appreciate that you guys are discussing a bigger issue than just me here. My personal situation, I did a study of the past year. So I have a studio right now that's being torn down to widen the freeway in the domain's reaching its hand in and taking my property away. But my personal studio is used maximum 3 days a month. So this isn't even a regular photography studio where people are going to be coming every day. It's so minimal in use, and the space is also being used for use as a gym and personal family get-together, things like that. So I just wanted to add that in, but I appreciate the discussion.
All right. There's nothing else from the council. That was a discussion item only. So, Chandler, do you feel like you've got enough direction?
Yeah.
Okay. We will move on to item number 13, which is a review action and public hearing on amendments to the city's general plan related to adopting a five-acre housing element.
I know that the mayor shares the sentiment with me that we don't want to go into the next legislative session that starts in a couple of weeks without a moderate housing plan. If you follow the news that goes on in the state over the course of the last year, 2 years, you'll know that the state is facing a housing shortage. There's just a lack of affordable housing within the state, especially within our area of Utah County. And so the state requires every city to have, as part of their general plan, a moderate income housing plan. And the city we're going to turn ours in about 16 years late. But we're going to turn it in. So that's what we have before you tonight. And I appreciate staff has been working with the Mountain Land Association of Government on developing this plan and coming up with what I feel are achievable policies, objectives, and goals that will not change the nature of the community, but will allow us to go to the state and say, look, here's what we're doing. And here's what we've done, actually.
So the moderate and housing plan is broken down into five sections. One is an estimate of the existing supply of moderate income housing. B is, two is the estimate of the need for moderate income housing. Three is a survey of the total residential land use. D, four is an evaluation of how the existing land uses and zones affect opportunities for moderate income housing. And finally, a description of the city's program to encourage and manage the supply of moderate income housing. Just if you're not aware of what moderate income housing is, they take the average median income of the area, which is our county, and they say 80% of that is a moderate income. And of that 80%, only 30% can be spent on housing, which includes your mortgage or rent, plus all the utilities required to live there. So just to kind of compare where the county is to where Cedar Hills is, in 2018, Utah County had an average median income of $74,700. Cedar Hills, we have $107,840, a difference of $33,000. It's a significant difference, and this is where it becomes problematic for the city in terms of creating a plan for moderate housing in that demographics here. It makes a really nice community, but it doesn't make it open to first-time homebuyers. It's usually established families that are looking to stay long-term. So, with that, you can see that we've broken it down that of the $74,700, your maximum monthly income to be considered affordable would be just over $1,800, which MAG estimates that that would lead to a mortgage of $370,000. 80%, which would be the affordable housing, which would be $1,494 a month, would give you a mortgage of about $300,000. If you look at the housing supply for the city, you see that most of our housing stock is actually $300,000 to $499,000. So it's considered beyond scope of affordability. There's also other unique challenges that Cedar Hills faces in terms of moderate income housing, in that there's just not a lot of land to develop. If we wanted to put together a program to encourage moderate income housing, where do you put it? The remaining land that we have is on the hillside, and the hillside development is just terribly expensive because of the grade requirements that you ask council to get a spot for that. One thing I do want to change in this before we send it out to the state is that in this middle paragraph here, we say 2017 median gross income. Just to avoid any confusion, I want to change those numbers to 2018 to be congruent with the rest of the report. So that's one change we recommend.
So the moderate housing, is that like ownership or
it can be rent? It can be rent as well.
So how do we loosen on the
absolutely. No, you're right on point, and I'll get to that in just a second. So in this report, you see that based on their estimates, we have right here at the top right that red mark goes across the top one that says -80. That's what they're estimating our current housing stock is lacking is 80 units. And so the question the Councilmember Daly raises is, haven't we done some things to ease the burden, so to speak? And yeah, yes, you have. So if you go to the next document, which is it's the housing goals background. Staff is recommending four goals that the City Council pursue. One is to create and allow for reduce regulations related to accessory dwelling units in residential zones. We've already done that. So that one's completed. And it's working well. There's some hiccups that we've worked on internally on staff on how to process those applications, but I think that those are very workable problems. Two is to allow for housing in commercial mixed-use zones. We did this in the revamping of our code related to the commercial district a couple of years ago. That settlement agreement with the Cedar Gaines Group changed a lot of that. We were open to part of that being residential development, but with that being now all residential development, just about, I think 90% of it is residential development at this point, we can still show the state that we did rezone this land, make it available for residential development. I did have a meeting with David Weekly Homes today. There are new ones that are going to be developing out there. Even though they're smaller lots, smaller homes, they're not going to meet
what the state considers affordable housing. They're going to be nicer referendums. The third goal is consider utilization of programs made available to municipalities. That's just being, this just means the cities can stay aware of any grants and any monies that the state federal agencies are promoting to encourage moderate housing. More than likely, we won't qualify for those just due to our demographics. Those usually go to higher need areas. But I think that the city should still be apprised of them. And then last would be to allow for single room occupancy. If you don't know what single room occupancy is, it's if you live alone and you have a big house, you can rent out a certain number of rooms to unrelated individuals if you together live as a household unit. We cap that right now as we're living four unrelated individuals, so you and three others could live together. And we feel like that's currently allowed in our city. But we want to flesh that code out a little bit more and maybe make it a little bit clearer on how to comply with that. But those are the goals. And the state is proposing a bill next year that basically creates a menu list of items that you choose from. And these items that we've selected as goals are things that come from that menu. So we feel like the state will be okay with what our plan is. And I think that they need to understand that we face different challenges than American Four. We face different challenges than Pleasant Grove, even though our neighbors. We have a limited housing stock. Our demographics are just different in terms of income, and the housing stock that we do have is very different than the existing housing stock in adjacent communities because we're a fairly new community, which makes the housing stock a little more expensive. So I hope you've had a chance to read through these documents. Entertain any questions, any feedback, anything you'd like to change before we send this out to state. But it is something that we do want to pass tonight. If you have issues with it, I'd still love to pass something tonight and then bring it back for amendments at a later date.
I'm just going to add a few things. On the urgency of passing this tonight, as Chandler mentioned, this has actually been something we're supposed to have done many years ago. Last year at the LPC, one of the things that ULCC really was concerned with is county legislators are saying we have to take more land use control away from cities because we asked them to do this 20 years ago and they're still not doing it. So clearly they're not listening. And so ULCT's push this year has been cities help us out to get this done so that we can go back and say, yes, we are doing our part. I met with ULCT yesterday. They interviewed me there. They're giving me a ton of mayors to just say, what are you doing in your communities? And so I talked about the AE ordinance that we updated and how we need to eliminate the impact fees and reduce the registration fee and how we do allow for single room occupancy, that we allow for higher density along Hardy Boulevard and Canyon Road and North Carolina Boulevard where we have higher traffic better types of transportation. And even talking again tonight about allowing people to generate revenue out of their home helps them, makes their home more affordable for them. So one of the things that ULCT has really brought to our attention is that this legislative session there's going to be a push again on cities to accommodate affordable housing, and that one of their goals is to really call out specific cities that have not done what they're supposed to do. We just don't want Cedarville to be on that list.
There's times we don't want to be in the next
one. But I appreciate staff's work on this. It's been a lot of work. MAG has been fantastic to work with us on this. We rarely see feedback from workforce services saying that this plan would be approved by them. So that was my question.
We've run it by preliminary with them.
Okay.
There's also a biennial report that the city has to do every 2 years, regardless of whether the council approves it. We're just reporting to the state of what kind of changes have happened in the city's housing stock. So the city staff needs to fill that form out, send this in with our goals, policies, objectives, and get that to the state. We'd like to do that before the end of the year.
And I'm working on just a one sheet that we can, I already got the grant to Bree Brown and Dan Merckx about what we're doing here, so they better understand what we're doing. And I'm working on the grant one sheet that we can just get out to legislators so they know we can't do what Salt Lake City, we can't do what Harriman's doing, but we are actively trying to address this issue. We understand, we want to do our part. Here's what we have done, so that way they hopefully understand that not every city doesn't have the same capability, but that we are taking it seriously.
Thank you.
You don't want to treat this as every city has to do the same thing because every city faces unique challenges. But you do want to give the city the leeway to plan their own community. And I think this plan does. I think it follows what the bill that ULCT is proposing with some legislatures this upcoming session. So I think that this puts us in the target.
Yeah, agreed through it. Solid people together. It's a lot of stuff we've already talked about. I don't think anything should have been a surprise. And with something was a surprise here, it was just nice to see others behind it.
Go for it. Okay, I'd like to make a motion that we adopt moderate income housing element. Motion made by Councilmember Anderson. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Councilmember Ellsworth. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. We'll move on to item number 14, which is a review action on the resolution authorizing the mayor to sign the local agreement with Pleasant Grove City Agency to the Valley Vista Trail.
Last year, Pleasant Grove City approached me about developing phase two of their Valley Vista Trail system. Phase one, you can see it down here. It's on the southern end of their city. It's just above the canal. It runs up the hillside. It's a series of switchback trails that wind way up to the bottom of the Shoreline Trail, and then it has these other fingers that come out north. That was phase one. Phase two is all these other colors of the trail system that everything from pretty much here and down, all of this is in Pleasant Grove still. But in order for them to do their trail, they do need to build some trails in Cedar Hills. And that's where it comes up on the C101 page. There's a little bit of it on C102, but it's in purple. And some of this orange and red is in Cedar Hills. So there's a small portion of this in Cedar Hills. So let's zoom in on those. This should look familiar to at least one of you. But this is green line here. It's kind of hard to see as a projector, but it kind of serpentines its way up the hillside and then it pops out onto private property. This line here designates city property from private property. And Pleasant Grove has worked out agreements with that homeowner and I believe with Councilmember Anderson. They approached
it. So they have rescinded their agreement to allow the trail to go through.
Okay.
So Nick spoken with John from Pleasant Grove.
Who has a
board
of
Albans.
Okay.
I've spoken to him and they tell him they don't support having to go look through their yard anymore. And so that affects our side of the trail too. And so it's not, as far as I know, it's not going through our private property anymore.
This is news to me.
Yeah, I know. I was trying to say the council about that. They're trying to acquire land that Anderson owns on the other side of the Albans land. And they're going to reroute the trail.
So they're going to try to reroute the trail around the homes?
Yes.
Okay. Still, though, it will. Now, this agreement is. And we can table this tonight.
I agree right now.
This is interesting. I'm going to have to get in touch with Dion. But basically, the nice thing about this agreement is that this does put the onus for construction or maintenance for cost onto Pleasant Grove. So this isn't something the city's going to have to pay for. But with that, it's something that I feel like would benefit the city quite a bit. You can see that this right here, this is one of the Shoreline Trail. This portion of the trail system would be in Cedar Hills. I was going to have you pass this stuff, but I'm going to ask you to make one.
Sorry.
But you're good.
Well, I think it affects us more than anybody, so
it does.
We don't have a...
We had a sit-down meeting with Albans and Denise and shared some concerns, so I'm glad that you spoke your mind. I'm glad he did as well. I think it's a good call. Because I shared the same concern when he initially showed me the plans, I said you were going to have to work this out.
Glad
that it's being worked out.
Paul Olson and Mark Anderson were really excited about it. But, yeah.
Well, it's one thing to be excited about, and one thing that a lot of future driving may be going forward. But I will speak to the quality of the trail. I've been on the southern portion of it down here, the phase one. I've gone on runs up and down this trail system a number of times. It's well maintained, it's well groomed, it's taken care of. They shut it off when it's muddy. You cannot access it. The biker group, mountain bike groups that use it are very respectful. They don't overuse it as well. They coordinate who uses it so that you're not getting overuse and deterioration of the trail. And conversations with Pleasant Grove, these neighbors about the trail down here just south of it, they're initially very concerned about what that would do to their neighborhood. And he says that that's been actually a very good thing. They haven't complained at all. Good. So I think overall the trail is great, but I think that this is something we will want to work out with them on where that trail is going to go and how it's going to affect our residents. So I think in light of what my husband just shared, I would say we table this.
So I'm not a biker, but I'm a business partner, a big biker. And so I do know that the biking industry that does mountain biking and stuff, they're very self-regulated. And I mean, if it rains and stuff, I mean, it's really shunned, I know, for them to even ride on it and stuff. So I think that's great, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
It should be self-regulated, not city regulated or county regulated or whatever.
And so this agreement, there's really nothing the city's having to do. That's why we like it. So we've had requests for these types of trails in the past, and so it's a part of something that we don't have to.
Not have to do anything to be responsible for.
Do you
want to
make that motion?
Dates we had from this year and apply them to next year, making some changes in January because the first Tuesday of January is January 1st. So what we're planning on doing is having those meetings on the second and fourth Tuesdays of the month. But other than that, we've carved out a day for the Downing Festival at the beginning of June, eliminated the council meeting that's around July 4th, September, that was around Labor Day. And then the November 1, we always cancel the first one because of the election. And then December, we typically have a program.
I know that there might be some of these that we have to change, but we figure that out as we go.
I'll make a motion that we adopt resolution or ordinance number 12-18, 2018, C, D.
A.
A. Oh, resolution. A. Ordinance. A. In accordance, setting the time and place of the regular meetings of the City Council of the City of Cedar Hills, Utah.
Motion made by Councilmember Geddes. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilmember Ellsworth. Councilmember Reed.
Aye.
Councilmember Ellsworth.
Aye.
Councilmember Miller.
Aye.
Councilmember Anderson.
Aye.
Councilmember Geddes.
Aye.
Motion passes. We have a motion to adjourn.
Motion
made by Councilmember Bailey. Seconded by Councilmember Anderson. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.